All right. Well, first of all, I just want to say thank you very much for inviting me to this workshop. I have really enjoyed it a lot. I actually don't do any dark matter searches. And while Mini-Boon was very important, I think, in looking for dark photons, I actually wasn't a part of Mini-Boon during that period of running. So this is all just a little outside of what I usually do, and I have really enjoyed what I've been hearing so far. I do a lot of beyond standard model searches, and I do them across a range of experiments that go from, they're all neutrino experiments, and they go from a few MeV all the way up to PeV energies. And I had really big dreams when Mariangela asked me what my title would be. I have so many different things I'm working on, and I rarely get to talk about all of the beyond standard model searches that I do. But I felt that it was important for me to start out and describe the state of sterile neutrinos, because that's one of the main things that I do, and it ate my entire talk. So what's going to happen is I'm going to tell you all about the state of sterile neutrinos, and at the very end, I'm going to give you a bunch of references of really great beyond standard model stuff that I hope you will go and look at. And I'm sorry, Mariangela. Before I start talking about sterile neutrinos, though, I think you should always start with the three neutrino model, the neutrinos that we know and love that are out there. And all the experiments that I work on are neutrino oscillation experiments. So for a neutrino oscillation experiment, if you describe the masses as a hierarchy like you see right here, and you describe the mixings in terms of the PM&S matrix, it turns out that there are really five parameters that you can get at. There are three mixing angles and one CP violating parameter. And then there is the choice of hierarchy here, whether this small splitting is up at the top or down at the bottom. And I want to say that at this point, this three neutrino model is actually surprisingly well constrained. There's a huge experimental effort going on right now looking at the mass hierarchy and CP violation. And this is really coming to fruition. And one of the questions that I have for theorists here, all the way throughout my talk, you're going to get questions for the theorists out there. And one of the questions that I have is, if we measure these really well, what are the questions, the larger questions, that we're going to be able to answer? Because I think at this point there's kind of a disconnect between what we can actually measure and what is actually getting answered. The question for experimentalists is a little different. I would say the question for experimentalists is, how close are we to actually getting answers to this question? And I personally would tell you that I think we're very close. So I am, you will discover throughout this talk, a person who believes in global fits, that you take a lot of data from many different kinds of experiments, like the kinds that you see listed here. You put them all together and you can learn a great deal of information. And so what you see here is coming out of a group that I don't work with, but it's called newfit.org, and they regularly do the three neutrino global fits. And you see here delta CP plotted against all the different parameters that are out there, with the normal hierarchy up here and the inverse hierarchy down here. And you discover that actually we understand a lot about whether there's CP violation. It looks like it's going to be large, and it's far from zero, likely. And also that it looks like it's a normal hierarchy. And I will tell you that June 2018 is when we have Neutrino 2018, and there will be big updates to what you actually see already in here. So I actually think this is really coming to fruition much faster than a lot of people believed that it would. So that's kind of the status of the three neutrino model. I have to say that I find the questions interesting, but not as compelling for me as asking if there are new particles or new forces. And I have to admit that the particle that I most dearly like is the sterile neutrino. Here he is. So there's the other neutrinos sharing their exchange particle, while he's over here dancing to his own little tune, okay? And this is my favorite picture of sterile neutrinos. All right. I come about this because I'm motivated by looking at anomalies. I think it was the first speaker on the first day who mentioned that, you know, there are sort of three ways that you can come at physics. You can come at it from the point of view of being theory-driven, you can come at it from the point of view of being technology-driven, or you could be observation-driven. And I really liked that picture, and I think that that's really true. I'm one of the people who likes to come at things from the point of view of observations. And so I personally define an anomaly as a greater than 2 sigma signal. So It's definitely not settled, because it's. But I kind of like that threshold as the threshold for where I'm going to be particularly interested in what is going on. And that turns out that there are many anomalies out there in neutrino oscillation world that are consistent with a delta M squared, which is very large compared to the atmospheric splitting, which is 0.003 eV squared, or the solar splitting, which is an order of magnitude below that. So to try to fit in something like this, what people have been saying for many years is you take your three neutrinos and you add in an extra sterile neutrino. And your sterile neutrino then doesn't have the usual exchanges, so the usual kinds of interactions, but it is appearing in your mixing matrix. So you expand your mixing matrix to a 4x4 mixing matrix. You now have an extra mass state, this new 4, and so that gives you the delta M squared that's your extra degree of freedom in this picture. And you're mixing in the sterile, which is this very dark blue that I'm indicating. So the mixings are indicated by the colors that you see in this block. The 3 plus 1 model, it turns out to have enough data out there that it is constrained at some very, very minimal level by measurements. And so there's actually a paper that we've published, a group of, that I work with where we do fits, filling in this matrix. We don't fill in the last bottom row of this because you have to get that through unitarity. You have enough data to try to go after all of these. The way that people go after all of these is through new mu to new e appearance, new e disappearance, and new mu disappearance. And historically, with just these three pieces of information coming from vacuum oscillation experiments, we have gone after the elements in the mixing matrix that are called UE4, U mu4, and delta M squared. There has been a new result that came online about a year ago, which came from IceCube. IceCube can exploit matter effects looking for new mu disappearance. And that has actually turned out to help give a handle on the U-tau-4 also coming out of all of this. All right. So I have lots of anomalies. I'm going to tell you all about them in a couple of minutes. And I put them all together. I put them in a pot. I stir. What do I get out? I end up with a case where I can compare the chi-squared that I get for no sterile neutrino involved compared to the chi-squared that I get if there is a sterile neutrino, giving me a delta chi-squared that's really quite large compared to the difference in degrees of freedom. So that would tell you then that the 3 plus 1 model is actually very much preferred over the null model. The null model is not very preferred. So something is wrong. If you go out and you do fits with this and you pick, say, one of the different mixing angles that you can plot against versus delta M squared, it turns out you end up with three little islands that you see right here, and the best fit happens to be right at 1.75 eV squared at the moment. So that's pretty, you know, amazing. It's something that you stop and think. Our delta chi squared is actually quite large for putting in this new model. But you can ask a lot of other questions about whether the model actually makes sense. And one way you can do it is you can arbitrarily divide your data set and ask, do the pieces actually fit together in a consistent manner? And in fact, there's one way to divide it which isn't arbitrary at all, and that is to look at the appearance-only data sets, new mu to new e, versus the disappearance-only data sets. And these are related within a 3 plus 1 model, as you can see by the oscillation probabilities that I've written down here. So they all have to be having an oscillation wave with the same delta M squared. And then you see that the new E disappearance depends on UE4, the new mu disappearance depends on new mu4, and new mu to new E depends on both of those. So you should be able to divide in this way and come out with a self-consistent solution. So again, I show you this as a function of one of the mixing angles and also delta M squared. And I've drawn some lines to guide the eye. So the lines are the same on the two plots that you see here. And you see that the solutions for disappearance and the solutions for appearance are actually in different quadrants. Okay? And so that makes you uncomfortable. And this is the tension that people talk about when they say there's a tension between appearance and disappearance in a 3 plus 1 model. So what's going on with our delta M squared? Where are we wrong? Okay, well, the delta chi-squared. The problem with a delta chi-squared, or any kind of chi-squared, is that it's not sensitive to systematic errors. And so this is actually one of my favorite plots that I like to show my students when I'm teaching junior lab, which is what I'm teaching these days. So what you have here is four different plots, and it turns out that all four sets are identical in terms of the mean along x, the mean of the value of y, and the variance of y, and they all have the same chi-squared. But if you look at these plots, of course, you have a very different impression about this one compared to all of the others. So while something may be going on with our anomalies, it might not be a 3 plus 1 model. It just may be that the 3 plus 1 model tends to go in the right direction to cover whatever else might be going on. So we have to keep that in mind. So we have an alternative way to try to describe how well we understand our data. It's something which is called the parameter goodness of fit, and it brings in the model into the chi-squared as you try to work out what your chi-squared per degree of freedom should be. So what here is your global fit value, and you compare the chi-squared for your global fit to your chi-squared for your appearance alone and the disappearance alone added together. And then you also have to adjust your numbers of degrees of freedom in order to have this actually act like a probability. If you want to read all about how this acts like a probability, you can go to this reference that you see right here. And what it tells you is exactly what you saw in the plot that I showed you, that actually there's a pretty big difference between what your best fit is for the global compared to what you get if you're looking at appearance or disappearance. You can get much better fits for appearance or disappearance alone than you can when you try to put them together. So the parameter goodness of fit probability for a 3 plus 1 fit is pretty low. And you say, oh, so really nothing is going on here, right? Except that it turns out there's a problem with our parameter goodness of fit. And it has a very peculiar issue associated with it. Let's say that I have a model, a 3 plus 1 model, or any model, and it describes a signal, and those parameters for that signal happen to be the true parameters that are underlying it, x, y, and z. And let's say that I have some particular background that's a particularly pernicious and evil background, okay? That evil background is something which I don't understand completely, and I go and I subtract it the best I can as an experimentalist, but something is left behind. And that something that is left behind, when added to the signal that is the true signal, gives you something that looks exactly like a signal in that model, but with the wrong parameters. And it turns out that this is exactly something that can happen in some of our data sets. In particular, I'm going to show you an anomaly from the Mini-Boone experiment, where if you take an underlying signal, you add in a little bit of a background that was under-subtracted, you will get something that looks exactly like a signal, but in a completely different area of parameter space. Yes?
Could it be that your 3 plus 1 mixing matrix is not illusory?
Three plus one is a very challenged model, and I want people to think about other models, and that is exactly one of the ones to think about. An example is that it could be a 3 plus 2 or 3 plus 3 system, and we're only looking at 3 plus 1. So yeah. And that's what I think, that's the bottom line of my talk. I want you guys to figure out what the real model is, okay? Because I think we're really close with 3 plus 1, but yet, you know, there's something wrong. So I would like, first of all, for you all to think about how to come up with a better statistical test, because we really need a better statistical test beyond this parameter goodness of fit. And if you came up with something like this, this is widely usable in many, many types of experiments, including the dark matter experiments that we've been talking about. So please think about that. Okay, so now let me go through all of the anomalies. I want to begin with nu mu d nu e, just because that's where I sort of began with all of this in the field. In these experiments, you're looking for an electron neutrino interaction, so something that looks like that, in a sea of muon neutrinos. So you want your little yellow guy there. There are two experiments that have observed anomalies within muon flavor to electron flavor changes. The first, which is very, very famous, is LS&D. So with LS&D, I plot the signature along this axis, which is L over E, which is the classic way that you expect to have oscillations. So a peak like this is exactly what a signal should look like. So here they have the backgrounds in the green and the red. Here you see that their data, which is systematics and statistics added in quadrature, is sitting high above those backgrounds. And here you see what their best fit signal actually looks like compared to their data. Then there's also the mini-Boone experiment. The mini-Boone experiment was a follow-up to LS&D, where what we did was we made the distance 10 times larger, and so we had to go to 10 times higher energy in order to maintain the L over E. So now we're moving from, say, about 30 MeV over here up to, you know, on the order of 300 and higher over here. Mini-Boone ran in two modes, in neutrino mode and in anti-neutrino mode. Mini-Boone, we went from something that was really statistics limited to something which is now systematics limited. And this is a stacked plot showing you all of the different backgrounds. And you can see that there is a large excess sitting on top of those backgrounds. The largest one of those backgrounds is coming from PyNOT MISID. That's what the red is right there. So let's talk about that misidentification for a minute. Most conventional beams in the range of 100 MeV to a few GeV, that's where most of them run. And in those ranges, you get what you want for your signal, which is the charge-current quasi-elastic interaction. And you can also get a neutrino coming in. It interacts by the Z, it excites to produce a pi naught. And so this is the resonant neutral current resonant production of pi naughts. And that's a background. So what happens, here's our signal right here. And here we have our pi naught, and our pi naught just decayed to two photons in this picture. And I have a Cherenkov detector. Mini-Boone is a Cherenkov detector, so what I see are rings. So in this particular case right here, I see a fuzzy ring. If it was a muon, I would have gotten a very sharp ring. I can't see this proton coming out. It's below Cherenkov threshold, so I see nothing for a proton. And then I see two rings if a pi naught comes out. Okay? Ah, but there are cases where I might only see one photon from that pi naught. And it's not the case that you think. Most people, because they work at high energies, think, oh, it's the case where the two photons came together and you saw it as one photon. That is not the problem on Mini-Boone. The problem on Mini-Boone is either one photon leaves entirely in the detector, or else you have back-to-back photon decay, back-to-back pi naught decay. One photon is highly boosted, and the backward one is very weak, and so you can't pick it out in the detector. When you have a single photon, it will convert into an E plus E minus pair, and that E plus E minus pair is going to look just like an electron in your Cherenkov detector. So the worry is that Mini-Boone can confuse these signals. And in fact, a very small admixture of additional mis-ID'd pi naughts plus a real signal will give you a fake signal. This is exactly the background that can fool the PG test. A lot of people go around saying, oh, we think that Mini-Boone is all pi naughts. I have a backup slide if anybody wants to ask me about that. There's no way it's all pi naughts, and I can discuss why later. But it could be a little bit pi naughts that could be distorting the signature. Okay, so let's go to the oscillation formula. The oscillation formula looks like this, and I'm going to plot my data as a function of L over E. Here is the LS&D data. Here is the Mini-Boone data. And I have put onto it a few models. And these models, you'll see, miss right here at about 0.6, both on Mini-Boone and on LS&D. And I think that's an interesting clue. And then up here, you'll notice that Mini-Boone has data points that are going pretty high. That is actually where you would expect your pi naughts, if you had extra pi naughts, to be appearing, is up here. All right. So I will tell you that a lot of the issues in a 3 plus 1, when you're looking for tensions in 3 plus 1, come specifically from Mini-Boone and from NuMuD and NuE.
Can you explain some of the lines?
Sure. So the different models, they're all a 3 plus 1 model. And the delta m squared is, for example, 0.6 eV squared, 1.0 eV squared, and 2.0 eV squared. So what that does is that changes the frequency of your oscillation. And so that's why they're changing in terms of the frequency. Then they also have a different value of the mixing angle. And the mixing angle is what sets your amplitude. So if I have, for example, a very long frequency, very long wavelength, and I have a very large amplitude, I would get something that looks like that. Okay? All right. So this is where I want to stop on the new Mu to new E, but I do want to advertise that coming soon at Neutrino 2018, Miniboon is going to release new results. It's been happily running all of this time. And in fact, if you just take the signal that Miniboon had before and you ask, given these new statistics, where should Miniboon be at, it will be the first of the anomalies to be at 5 sigma. So we will see what actually happens there. Then later, not at Neutrino 2018, but hopefully not too much later, Microboon will be coming out with results on this too. So Microboon is an experiment that's been built directly in front of Miniboon. So it is looking in the same beamline for the same kind of effect. But there, it's a liquid argon TPC. And so what the different elements of an event look like are very, very different. So here you can see what an electron looks like. Here you can see what a pi naught looks like. In this detector, you can see the tiny little proton stub. And very importantly, here with the electron, in 85% of the cases, you can tell in the first 2 centimeters whether you had 2 ionizing particles or only 1 ionizing particle. And so you can tell electron from E plus, E minus. So in the first day, somebody brought this up as something that you might want to do in, I think it was Jonathan's experiment, and you can get to that and be able to differentiate between photons and electrons at about the 85% level in an experiment that's built for it. And the rest of it, you're nailed by fluctuations. So that's why I said what I said. So if you have 2 photons, then you will know immediately that it is a pi naught. We have a nice pi naught mass peak. If we lose one, and this is a much smaller detector, so almost all of the ones we lose are ones that exit, and then we have to look at just that shower, and 85% of the time we'll be able to tell you whether that was an electron or a photon, which isn't great, but it's a whole lot better than 0%. And so the combination of that and the fact that you can see the proton coming out, so you would know whether that photon is actually at, whether the electromagnetic shower is attached to the vertex or not, is very, very powerful for getting rid of backgrounds. Okay. All right, so now let me go to the second kind of anomaly that's out there. That's the new E disappearance. And the most interesting area in the electron flavor is really coming from the reactor studies. So that's what I'm going to completely focus on. So this is a case of inverse beta decay where an anti-electron neutrino comes in, it interacts, you get a positron out and a neutron out, the neutron will capture, so you get a coincident signal, first from the positron and then from the neutron. Now, many experiments over many years had run at reactors at short baseline, and they had all said, oh, we don't have any kind of an anomaly. And they were comparing to data that was taken at ILL in the 1980s. And so when DoubleShow decided to start bringing out their result, a group on DoubleShow said, okay, there's a lot of new information since the 1980s on all of the different cross sections for a reactor. Let's just put all of that in and we'll get a better reactor flux prediction. So what happened was that the world was sitting on this blue line and thought that blue line was 1 for data divided by prediction. And when the new analysis came out, 1 moved up to here, and now everybody had an excess. Or, I'm sorry, a deficit. So everybody suddenly had a signal. And this is the start of something I'm going to say over and over again in this talk, which is we really need to think carefully about limits, because everybody was just accepting what that prediction was and wasn't really looking carefully at that prediction. Believe me, since that time, they have been looking very carefully at that prediction. And one of the things that you can say is that if that overall offset in the predicted rate that's giving you that deficit is due to oscillations, then you should see that effect throughout the reactor burn cycle. So you should see the neutrinos that are coming from the uranium and also the neutrinos that are coming from the plutonium both show a deficit. So what happened was that Daya Bay decided to look at what their total cross-section looked like as a function of time, which you could either describe as the number of uranium-235 you have or the number of plutonium-239 you have. And they found that It didn't fall exactly as you would expect. This best fit did not fall on the line here. If you plot their data, which you see right here, compared to the flux prediction, what you see is you see that there is a big deficit in the direction of the uranium, and there's not a big deficit in the direction of the plutonium. So that would say, oh, maybe this is not really coming from oscillations. Maybe it's coming from not knowing how reactors burn. This has turned out to be incredibly controversial, this result. And you can find many, many, many papers on this and saying that this is wrong. I don't want to go either way in saying whether it's right or wrong. An oscillation should oscillate. And so that's what we really need from the reactor experiments. What we need are experiments which don't rely on just seeing an overall deficit. What we want is to have a result which looks as a function of energy and sees a wiggle. And what's really interesting is, as of January, two reactor experiments have come out, both of which seem to be showing wiggles, and the wiggles are consistent. So the best of those reactor experiments, in my opinion, is DANCE. DANCE has a detector which literally dances. It moves from one position to the next position. They do it every day. So throughout the reactor cycle, every day, this detector is moving from top to bottom. And so they do a ratio of down to up, and that's a large enough change in position that you should see the you should see a wiggle as a function of energy. And that's the wiggle that they're seeing right now. And this is going to be updated for sure at Neutrino 2018. You can take that result and you can then ask, okay, if I take the NAOS experiment, which actually sits still, and it is running at a reactor in Korea, and you normalize that data to the Dia-Bay data. So in this case, it's not really a theoretical prediction. You're normalizing to actually the Dia-Bay data. You also get something that looks like it fits the wiggle. And so people, and I would just say over here, there's this known issue with Dia-Bay, so you should ignore what's in the circle. Both of these experiments will be updating at Neutrino 2018. In fact, there are reactor experiments everywhere, okay? People are really excited about this. And another experiment, besides the two that I just told you about, which is just turning on, I don't think they'll have results by Neutrino 2018, but they will by fall, I think, is the PROSPECT experiment right here. So there's quite a bit that's coming out, and all of these experiments are moving toward being able to see an oscillating effect to try to understand the anomalies. All right. So then there's the question of new mu disappearance. And I want to first talk about vacuum oscillations, and then I'll talk about matter effects. This is a really interesting case because this is the case where there are no anomalies. There are anomalies in nu E disappearance and anomalies in nu mu to nu E, but there haven't been anomalies at the 2 sigma level. There are weird little bumps, but not below 2 sigma, in the muon disappearance. And so all of these are limits. And I have realized something. There's been an enormous amount of scrutiny that has gone into the reactor studies because they have an anomaly. There's been an enormous amount of scrutiny that's gone into Mini Boone and LS&D because they have anomalies. But I will show you that very little scrutiny actually goes into people who set limits. So let's take Minos Minos Plus as an example. They just brought out a paper which they submitted to PRL. It says that on the site, so that's how I know that. And there's just something seriously wrong with this limit. It is showing non-standard model behavior in the limit, and you cannot take this at face value. And yet the community is all like, oh, it's a limit, we should just put it in. So let me show you what's wrong with Minos, okay? So Minos is running in the NUMI beamline, let me tell you that. That's going to come back in a few minutes. Consider increasing L over E in this direction and increasing delta M squared in this direction. And what you have is you have a case where if you're a very low delta M squared, you see no oscillation in the beam pipe, there's no oscillation in the near detector, you see something in the far detector, and that lets you measure the atmospheric oscillation really well. Then if you go up in delta M squared, so now this was 0.003, let's go up to about 0.3 or so, what will happen is that the far detector, you'll have very, very rapid oscillations. You won't be able to understand that those are individual oscillations. They will be smeared. And so effectively what you're measuring is a half there. that term in the oscillation probability becomes a half. You have a near detector, though, that is starting to see some shape as a function of energy. And so with that, you can use this far detector to normalize the near detector, putting in the extra factor of 2 that you're missing, and you can look at oscillations at about 0.3 eV squared. Now let's just keep on going up. Let's go up to, say, 30 eV squared or higher. In that case, you have rapid oscillations in the far detector, you have oscillations in your near detector, and you might be able to resolve them, but the problem is you have lots of oscillations in your beam pipe also. And the actual place where the neutrino was produced varies along your beam pipe, so everything ends up smeared. So here at lower delta M squared, you can use the near-far ratio, and many systematics will cancel the cross-sections, the flux, and so forth. At higher delta M squared, you have to use your absolute predictions of your flux, and your absolute predictions of your cross-section, and your absolute predictions of your tonnage. And that's going to give you a far worse limit. And in between, there should be a turnover. Okay, this is what they showed at Neutrino 2016. At Neutrino 2016, this is the mixing angle along this axis, delta M squared along this axis. As we go up in delta M squared, they go out to where they have real sensitivity, because that's where the near-far ratio gives them their sensitivity. And then they have this turnover, and it goes back over to poor sensitivity, because that's where, from first principles, they had to predict what was going on. Okay? Now let's look at their latest paper. Okay? I want to point out here that at this turnover was actually happening between like a 5 and 10 eV squared is where it starts, and up here at 100 eV squared, it was completely done. Here, they're going up to 1,000 eV squared, and their plot just goes right up, straight up, okay? So they don't have a turnover anymore, and that just doesn't make any sense, okay? This is the wrong behavior at high delta M squared. And so, you know, they put this out. I called them up, I said, you've got the wrong behavior at high delta M squared. They said, well, this is what the code gives us. And I believe that. What happened is that they changed fluxes. And so they changed from a flux that they were using before for their prediction to the Minerva flux. And what Marco Levader, another person who does FITS, realized is that the Minerva flux is not an ab initio flux. The Minerva flux, what they do is they come up with a first principles prediction, and then they constrain it to what they actually see in the Minerva detector for neutrino electron scattering. That's such a beautiful thing, because the cross-section is so well known, you can extract your flux really well. So what happens then is that they change the overall flux prediction by lowering the overall flux prediction significantly to match data that came out of the NUMMI line. So what's going on, because Minerva sits here and Minos sits right in front of them, is that Minerva measured the flux, and then Minos used that measurement to predict the flux that they should see in their near detector. It's a completely circular argument. You cannot actually see neutrino oscillations with an argument like that. I think that that's a lot of what's causing their weird behavior, because that's certainly going to cause your systematics to go off in a strange direction. I don't know that it's all of the behavior. But I'd also like to point out that the Minerva new E scattering actually looks very strange. These are their data points for the new E scattering, and this is the ratio of data to what you would expect, and it actually has a dip. It has a shape, like everything seems to have shape in this world. So something really strange is going on, and you can't believe those limits. And the message that I really want to give you is, if we're ever going to discover anything, we have to be as critical of limits as we are of signals and anomalies. It's a really important thing to really ask a lot of questions. You know, that one was just too easy, right? And I'm actually asking for it, because most of the other new mu limits that are out there are actually from experiments I was on, so you would be yelling at me. But that's okay. I want you guys to really ask those questions. All right. The last thing I wanted to talk about was new mu disappearance from matter effects. This is a really neat new way of going about things that has just recently come on the stage from the Ice Cube experiment. So the Ice Cube experiment is using high-energy neutrinos in the TeV range. They travel all the way through the Earth, so there's a lot of change of matter density as the neutrinos come in. If I pick just one path length and I look at the energy, what happens in this case is that you end up with a resonance at a very particular energy, okay? And when I plot this, I plotted a really big example of what the resonance would look like. The size of that resonance depends on your mixing angle. So this is a beautiful, enormous signal. It's very, very different from the vacuum oscillation signal. Now, you would like to be able to explore that as a function of L and E. In IceCube, L, the way you get L is by looking at neutrinos that are coming in at different angles to your detector, which is located down here. You have to remember that matter effects are different for neutrinos and for antineutrinos, and you see this is actually happening in the antineutrinos. The neutrinos are just showing standard oscillations in this model. So as a result, that really smears out your ability to see things because there's a lot more neutrinos than there are antineutrinos. Nevertheless, we were able to set a really beautiful limit from IceCube on this. So that's the limit that came out of IceCube because we did not see a giant missing region when we plotted cosine theta versus energy. All right, and what that did actually was it took away the island that was the primary island that people were working toward. Everybody talks about 1 eV squared as a solution for this, and in fact, that became highly disfavored, and this became the most favored solution. IceCube has 6 times the data set, and in fact, is improving the analysis, so we'll have even more data in the analysis. And that, I think, will be ready by the end of summer. So I think you'll see a big new result coming out of this by the end of summer also. All right. So what I'm saying to you is that 3 plus 1 is a highly challenged model, and yet the experimental results really have staying power. In fact, I think Mini-Boon is headed straight to 5 sigma. The number of anomalies, and in particular anomalies with wiggles, are growing. So the NAOS and DANCE is showing up. Potentially, the NumiFlux actually has an anomaly in it because it's got a deficit. It's appearing across many orders of magnitude and energy, and that's the kind of test that you want to have, so that things are really, really different, but the whole overall picture kind of fits together. So the basics are pretty uniform. We're seeing something that looks like an oscillatory effect, and if you interpreted it as 3 plus 1, it's in the 1 to 10 eV squared region. But with that said, going back to Suber's comments, we need better models, and we need to think beyond, I think, just sterile neutrinos, too. I would really like to see us start thinking beyond that. So I've spent a lot of time on looking at 3 plus 2 and 3 plus 3 models. That's one of the things my fitting group does a lot of. We do simple ones. We only have 1 CP parameter. Adding additional parameters may be needed, and that's kind of computationally heavy, so we haven't done that. In fact, I've gotten distracted with a new model, which is a 3 plus 1 plus subleading decay model. So it's something which looks like this, where it's the mass state that's decaying. And the reason why I like that is because coming back to the L over E plot that I was showing you earlier with the different shapes of the neutrino oscillation signal on it, you'll notice that what it does is it pulls things down at the low values so that you get better agreement with data points here. And it looks like our global fit on this is going to be really good, and we're going to bring that out for neutrino. Is it crazy to say that it's a more complex model? I get criticized a lot by saying, you know, it's a more complex model. They're like, oh, you know, it's 3 plus 1. If it's not 3 plus 1, then it's just all wrong, right? But let's think about this a little bit. If we had not understood when we had the 3 neutrino signals, if we had not understood that there was MSW, that there was this extra thing going on, we would actually be trying to force oscillations down here at the 10 to the minus 10 level. And we would never be able to fit anything, right? So it has been true in the past that we have needed a more complicated model. It isn't a crazy thing to say that. I also think we need better experiments. All of the signals are really at the margin of sensitivity, and that is true of a discovery, I think. Witness the Higgs, okay? So what do you do when you have a not great signature? Well, you try to build a bigger collider. That was a really good tactic. They did really, really well. The signature of this anomaly is that it wiggles. And so what you want to do in this case is build experiments that trace the oscillation wiggle. So I want to make an advertisement for an experiment which I am helping to put together, which is called the ICIDAR experiment. The idea of ICIDAR is to use lithium-8 decay at rest, which is a very well-understood spectrum of anti-electron neutrinos coming out, pair it with the CAMLAN detector. The lifetime of this is very short, so you have to constantly be producing it. So this means I'm building a really big cyclotron. And it's got really, really beautiful capability of reconstructing what the wiggles actually look like. So here, for example, I show you the wiggle that you would expect for a standard 3 plus 1 model. And here's the wiggle that you would get if you had instead 3 plus 1 plus decay. And I think that's the kind of thing we really, really need in order to be able to clarify things. There's a huge power in being able to trace that oscillation wave to high precision. So I just want to say, ICIDAR needs your help. Yeah?
So why does the decay look different?
So what's happening is you're losing your new 4. So it's the new 4 state, the new 4 mass state that's decaying away. So you're losing it as you go away in L. And so that's why that's disappearing. Right. And it's quite a striking signature. It doesn't look anything like any of the other models. I could put in a 3 plus 2 and it would look completely different. So I can tell these models apart. So let me just make a plea. ICIDAR really needs your help because we're working toward a really major proposal at NSF. And really, these things go through because there is strong support from the theory community for them. And so I'm really hoping that you'll think about this and say that this is actually really valuable and really important, and that you'll support our primary goal of the sterile neutrino studies. But also, I'm hoping you realize that this is a new sandbox to play in, that this is a new kind of experiment. We understand our flux incredibly well. We have a beautifully calibrated detector. And so if you have other physics that you would like us to do, we are happy to help you understand whether they can be done. All right. So I admit that I really like this little guy, and that's why I spend a lot of time talking about him. My title was actually BSM Searches with Neutrinos from MeV to PeV Energies, and I do other things too. So I just want to advertise to you, because I think you might be particularly interested in IceCube's great new Lorentz violation search that we're bringing out. So that's this one right here. And also, because all of you are very interested in dark matter, I want to point out a really nice new paper by my postdoc, Carlos Arguelles. What he did was he looked at the very isotropic distribution that IceCube sees for the high-energy neutrinos. He realized some fraction of those have to be coming through the dark matter, the very highly dense region of dark matter in the galactic center. And so you can actually set limits on neutrino-dark matter interactions that are better than cosmology in some parameter ranges. And we're going to bring out a collaboration paper on that, I think, very soon, hopefully by the end of summer. So please ask me about my other BSM work and other ideas at coffee or at dinner or whatever, and thank you very much.
Thanks very much. We've just got a few minutes for questions.
I'm sorry, I ate into my time.
So do you know what the projections look like for the 6 more years of IceCube data and how that should overlap?
Yeah, I do. It looks kind of like this. So it will extend the nose further outward, and it extends upward so that it nips off 50% of this guy. And also, it's enough extra data that you can fit for theta 3, 4. You can fit for the UTAU 4 as well as the UME 4 at the same time also, which will be really, really nice. So in a single experiment, you can fit for both.
So I'm wondering about something that you didn't mention, since you want to reduce the systematics, namely the cross-sections of neutrinos on nuclei, mm-hmm. the MeV, GeV. So how important are those, or how well are they? Because I know there are some
right.
experiments that are being constructed to measure those more precisely, right?
Right. Let me, let me go back to...
What's the relation to these?
Right. So for the experiments that are running right now, which are the shared baseline experiments that are running right now, what really, really matters is the charge current quasi-elastic cross-section. So this one right here. It's a relatively simple cross-section, although there are some theoretical errors. But the trick that you do is to realize that the cross-section for the muon new mu interaction should be the same as the cross-section for the new E interaction up to effects of the mass of the muon, which you can describe very well. So in experiments like that, what you do is you first go out and see if you see any neutrino disappearance, a new mu disappearance. If you don't see any effect like that in the new mu, you can use the new mu to constrain the new E, and that really, really reduces your cross-section errors on this. The other thing that you can do is you can run a near-far experiment even at short baselines. And that's underway at Fermilab. So they're building a near detector for microboon, which is called SBND. Well, I look forward to talking to you all more, and thank you very much.
Yeah, let's thank them.
Oh no! So I was careful, Laura. Look! I did this just for you. This is just for you here. I was very careful. Oscillations give you these parameters, right? Yeah. I think you'll hear more about Majorana neutrinos from Lindley. She's going to be here tomorrow, giving a talk, and so she'll be. You'll get that from her.